making TV special.
Donuts. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Welcome, boys and girls, to the B-side of episode 105 of Media Monarchy. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. You just heard more new music from Franz Ferdinand. That track's called Ulysses. Coming to you from, as always, Portland, Oregon. It's about 5:30 in the evening, Thursday, January 8th, 2009. And there's so many god-awful things going in the world, it's tough to keep up, as I've said many, many times. But I try and do it for you, so that's why we now record an extra episode, and by we, I mean me. Because I can't cram it all into the Friday morning Portland Radio Authority and Revere Radio Network show. So we do it here, and I do it from my apartment in Portland, Oregon. A lot to go over, even for a B-side, so let's get to it. EnviroHealth, pesticides, Gardasil, and six-legged soldiers. First from the Daily Mail. I had to check into it because their original headline is Orange Drinks. But, of course, it's Fanta. The Nazi drink. We went over it just a few weeks ago. Fanta, Coke, Nazis, profiteering, all that. And as if that weren't enough, it'd be, you know, it'd be one thing if they're profiteering off something. Oh, it was pretty good for you anyway, though. But no, Fanta has 300 times more pesticide than tap water. again, from the Daily Mail. Fizzy drinks sold by Coca-Cola in Britain have been found to contain pesticides at up to 300 times the level allowed in tap or bottled water. A worldwide study found pesticide levels in orange and lemon drinks sold under the Fanta brand, which is popular with children, were at their highest in the UK. The research team called on the government, the industry, and the company to act to remove the chemicals and called for new safety standards to regulate the soft drinks market. The industry denies children are at risk and insists that the levels found by researchers based at the University of Jaén in southern Spain are not harmful. 300 times more pesticide in tap water is fine. Now, flashback to only November of 2008 when we went over Fanta, the drink of the Nazis. Next is more from Merc Mercenaries. You can, of course, follow the links and hit the flashbacks and hit the post labels of just about Merc on MediaMonarchy.com, and it spins quite the twisted tale, even just covering the last couple years that I've been doing this website. But now, this from the Wall Street Journal. Merck seeks FDA approval for Gardasil in boys. And just so you know, my flashback link goes back to September of 2007, the latest absurd marketing scheme from Merck. But now, recently, Merck is asking federal regulators to expand the use of its human papillomavirus HPV vaccine to boys and young men. The company has asked the FDA to approve the Gardasil vaccine's use in males ages 9 to 26 to prevent genital warts and other lesions. This sourced to CNBC with a link. In 2006, the FDA approved giving the vaccine to girls and women of those ages. We, Wall Street Journal, talked with a Merck spokeswoman who pointed to studies with a link showing Gardasil's effectiveness in young males, but the request will likely renew questions about Gardasil's cost-effectiveness with a link, especially with a price tag of $360 for a three-dose regimen. In August, Harvard researchers suggested the vaccine wasn't worth the cost in older women likely to have been exposed to HPV by the time they were to get vaccinated. Merck has also asked the FDA to expand Gardasil's use to women ages 27 to 45. The vaccine, Gardasil, is a key product for Merck, which estimates sales this year of as much as $1.6 billion. But sales have slowed, down 4% in the third quarter compared to a year earlier. Next, they'll have it for your microchipped pets. Finally, thirdly, on this EnviroHealth posting, pesticides, Gardasil, and six-legged soldiers, it's time for the six-legged soldiers. This from Danger Room, but going all around the world, to The Telegraph and out of Canada and The Times Online and more, terrorists could enlist six-legged soldiers in bio attack. Of course, from Danger Room. Terrorists could easily contrive an insect-based weapon to import an exotic disease, according to an entomologist who's promoting a book on the subject. Jeffrey Lockwood, an entomologist at the University of Wyoming, is on the talk show circuit to promote his new book, Six-Legged Soldiers, Using Insects as Weapons of War. He told BBC Radio 4's Today program that planning a bioterror attack using insects would, quote, probably be much easier, end quote, than developing nuclear or chemical weapons. Today does not post the transcript of BBC, but the Daily Telegraph quotes and links him as saying, quote, it would be a relatively easy and simple process, a few $100 and a plane ticket, and you could have a pretty good stab at it. Nothing like a little bio-warfare scare to drum up sales for your book. Military historian Max Hastings, for one, gave Lockwood's book a less-than-stellar review last weekend in the London Sunday Times, but he also noted, quoting Max Hastings, the last section of Lockwood's book is the most plausible and interesting because it addresses the risks of biological terrorism in our own times. In particular, the author speculates about the consequences if terrorists were to broadcast Aedes aegypti, that's Latin, and you can hit the Wikipedia entry for the mosquito that carries the yellow fever virus. the consequences of a yellow fever epidemic in America, where scarcely anyone is inoculated against the disease, could be devastating. As Noah Shackman has noted here on Danger Room before, biodefense labs have soaked up massive amounts of funding in recent years to deal with precisely this kind of theoretical threat. But the real question thus far seems to have been whether the boom in biodefense research has actually made us safer. And I would, of course, say unequivocally no. These things always strike me as so kind of simple and stupid. Level 4 and 5 bioterror labs in the US and UK, and of course handfuls of other places, are the only places that can create these sort of things. So when they get out, you know pretty sure where they've come from. Whether it's foot and mouth or anthrax, or Lyme disease, it's coming from the labs. It's also interesting to note, Danger Room throws out, I believe I counted as I was reading there, three references that this guy was promoting and flogging his book and scaring up, drumming up book sales. So, kind of a backhanded thing, because again, as we note on Danger Room, there's hardly a military op they don't dislike. But we'll hit another one from them. That's the interesting thing. They get information out, but it's... they're not stupid. Mind control, yesterday and today. First, vets sue CIA over mind control tests. For two decades or more, the CIA and the military allegedly plied the unwitting with acid, weed, and dozens of psychoactive drugs in a series of zany and sometimes dangerous mind control experiments. Allegedly, they say. Now, the Vietnam Veterans of America are suing the agency and the Pentagon for perceived abuses suffered under the so-called MKUltra and other projects. Six vets are suffering from all kinds of ailments tied to this, quote, diabolical and secret testing program, according to a statement from the vets' lawyers passed on to Spy Talk's Jeff Stein, that's over at Congressional Quarterly, with links for you, of course. The experiments allegedly included, quote, the use of troops to test nerve gas, psychochemicals, and thousands of other toxic chemical or biological substances, and the insertion of septal implants in the brains of subjects in mind control experiments that went awry, leaving many civilian and military subjects with permanent disabilities. Subjects were tested without their consent, the veterans say, and when the trials were over, the government failed to provide health care or compensation. In a book published last year, former military psychiatrist James Ketchum describes an Army project separate from the CIA's efforts that took place at Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. James Ketchum's book and links to audio and video goes back to April of 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com. There, James Ketchum saw test subjects carry on conversations with various invisible people for as long as 2 to 3 days. Others salute latrines and attempt to revive a gas mask that they mistake for a woman. The feds insist that MKUltra ended when it was exposed during congressional hearings. I believe those would be the Church Committee hearings. Or was it the Rockefeller Commission? But interest in chemical mind control lives along in some corners of the military intelligence community. In 2003, a memo by then Justice Department lawyer John C. Yu suggested that interrogation drugs could be used if their effects were not permanent or profound. Since then, evidence has accumulated that some detainees may have been drugged. Quote, it's coming back, end quote, retired Colonel John Alexander told Sharon Weinberger of Danger Room. Just some of the links in there will take you to the Washington Post and again CQ Politics, as well as more from Danger Room and Wired and Threat Level and Media Monarchy and ForgottenSecrets.net. So that's vets suing the CIA and the Pentagon over mind control tests done decades ago, or as my post title suggests, yesterday, mind control yesterday and today. Today, from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, relatives of terror suspect say feds use mind control. This is actually from January 5th from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Relatives of terrorism suspect Esenol Islam Sadiqi, last name S-A-D-E-Q-U-E-E, accused federal authorities Monday of using mind control tactics intended to induce a guilty plea. Sadiqi's family leveled the accusations after a court hearing in which Sadiqi pleaded not guilty to a recently returned amended federal indictment. Sadiqi and former Georgia Tech student Saeed Harris Ahmed are being held without bond on charges they conspired to provide material support to terrorists. At Monday's hearing, Sadiqi asked U.S. Magistrate Judge Jerry Lynn Brill for an exorcist to free the demons placed in his head by authorities. Magistrate Brill denied the request. Appearing in prison garb, canvas slip-ons, a long beard, and an off-white knit cap, Sadiqi took the unusual step of speaking for himself in court. He told Brill that he had been subjected to psychological abuse at the federal penitentiary where he is being held. He accused Ahmed, that is the aforementioned former Georgia Tech student Saeed Harris Ahmed, who has pleaded not guilty also, of being a confidential informant. Informants provocateured phony terror cases. And when you get busted, and they're going to run mind control ops on you, you can hit up Sadiqi and Ahmed. Both have Wikipedia entries. And there's some good research links that you can hit there as well. Mind control yesterday and today. Next, a quick one from the Associated Press. Spanish cops seize 40,000 doses of psychoactive drug used by shamans. Spanish police have raided a house in Madrid, in a Madrid suburb, rather, arrested two people and seized 40,000 doses of a psychoactive substance traditionally used by South American shamans. The substance Yahi, that's Y-A-J-E, or ayahuasca, as it's known in its ancient Inca language, with links for you to learn more about that. Ayahuasca is derived from a hallucinogenic jungle vine used for centuries in religious and healing ceremonies. Investigators were alerted to its suspected distribution by an organization in the La Rosas suburb, the Interior Ministry said in a statement last Monday. Three miners were among 21 people taking part in a ceremony when police raided the house in late December. The agency said the estimated value of the seized drug was $1.663 million. The Pharmacratic Inquisition is where you need to go to learn about these ancient psychoactive drugs and entheogens. But unfortunately, right now, we have to turn to the Econo crash. Again, as we've been trying to get through everything on the radio, on the podcast for MediaMonarchy.com, it's hard to keep up. So right now, we're going way back to December 28th. Econo crash, recession, depression, elites, and aggression. First, a video. The elite are turning a recession into a depression.
Jim Rogers joins us now from Miami. Mr. Rogers, thank you very much indeed for joining us once again on Bloomberg Television. I just said it in the introduction. You've seen recessions, slumps, crashes. You've thrived through them. How bad is it now?
It's amazing how old I am, isn't it? I hadn't thought about it that way. I've seen actually more than that. Well, this is going to be probably the worst since the Second World War, as far as the American economy is concerned, and some of the, especially the UK economy. Well, it won't be the worst since the Second World War for the UK, but it's going to be very bad. bet, for all of us.
People are talking about the D word, depression. From what you've just said, it doesn't sound it's going to be quite as bad as that.
Well, it could well be. As you remember, the depression in 1929 was the stock market bubble, which popped. We were going into a recession, and then the politicians around the world started making horrendous mistakes, which turned it into a depression. It would have been just a normal recession otherwise, but the American politicians and then the European politicians, everybody got in the act, and that seems to be happening this time too, Mr. Stevenson. They're making a lot of mistakes.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're expecting some of the same. Are you planning for a worst-case scenario?
Well, I cannot tell you until I see how things unfold. Nobody knew in 1929 it was going to turn into the Depression. By 1931, some of the smart people had figured it out. These things unfold, I'll have to watch and see what happens. I'm certainly prepared for the worst, and if it happens, I hope I take the appropriate action.
And given what you heard from the central bankers and from the politicians thus far, are you impressed or deeply unimpressed by what you've seen?
Well, I'm impressed, very negatively impressed. It's astonishing how bad they're reacting this time. It is unfathomable to me what they're doing. You would think that some of them would have read some history or interpreted history properly.
What about
Mr. Obama, our new president, Mr. Obama, has said, ran on a platform that he's going to do two things. He's going to tax capital. This is a period when the world is desperately short of capital. What a genius. And then he's going to protect America. Protectionism led to the Great Depression in the 1930s. So we got a man now who says he's going to in favor of protectionism and taxing capital. If that happens, Mr. Stevenson, it's all over.
That's veteran investor Jim Rogers warning about the policies of the central banks and politicians are turning what would have been a recession into a new Great Depression. And then, of course, Obama's taxation agenda will only make the problem much worse. Article, longer video, longer article from Paul Joseph Watson. Jumping to Truth News and jumping to another famous economist and author, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, says that the crash will be worse than the Great Depression.
One of the world's hottest investment advisors these days, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, author of The Black Swan, who's been warning of a crash for years, betting on one and winning big. He's been ubiquitous in the financial media of late, from cable TV's Colbert Report to the BBC's Newsnight, where he was infuriated by what he called bogus accounting.
The first thing I would get immediately, I would suspend something called value at risk, quantitative measures of risk used by banks immediately.
We sat down with Taleb and the man he calls his mentor, mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot, pioneer of fractal geometry and chaos theory. And even more than feeling vindicated, they're both scared.
I don't know if we're entering the most difficult period since, not just the Great Depression, since the American Revolution.
The most serious situation we've been in since the American Revolution?
Yeah.
Professor Mandelbrot, can that possibly be true?
It's very serious.
More serious than the Great Depression, possibly?
Possibly, I hope not.
Cotton and the farmer to grow the cotton.
Mandelbrot's key insight came in the 60s with a study of cotton price surges and plunges, suggesting the world moves in fits and starts, especially the human world. Decades later, after the stock market crash of 1987, Taleb came to the same conclusion. He appeared on the NewsHour 2 years ago to help explain the death of a hedge fund before the current crisis. He dubbed the event a black swan. Impossible, Europeans had always thought, because they'd never seen one.
We saw a lot of white swan. Every white swan was confirming that, you know, hey, all swans were white.
Taleb's book, published in April 2007, was called The Black Swan because in 1697, Dutch explorers discovered Australia and black swans.
And sure enough, they saw that blackbird and said, hey, one single observation, okay, can destroy thousands of years of confirmation. So likewise in the markets, all you need is one single bad moth to destroy years of track record.
In an interview with Nassim Nicholas Taleb, famous economist and author of The Black Swan, knowing that the present economy and the situation is far more serious than the Great Depression and the economy during the American Revolution. Moving to The Age out of Australia, secrecy surrounds those receiving Federal Reserve trillions. The Fed is refusing to speak, raising fears that things could end in the deepest of depressions. One of the many elephants cluttering the denial room of extremely high finance in the U.S., the daddy of them all, the veritable woolly mammoth, remains undisturbed. The Federal Reserve has formally refused a request by Bloomberg News that would have poked the sleeping giant. It didn't raise a tusk. Bloomberg has taken on the task, abrogated by the rest of the U.S. financial media, to keep the bastards, if not honest, aware they're being watched. I believe this must have been syndicated from someone in the Bloomberg agency, because they're basically patting themselves on the back saying, we're the ones trying to figure it out. But that's just another example of we don't know where the bailout trillions are going. Next, from the New York Post, a Madoff investor found dead, a French financial executive whose firm lost a bundle in Bernard Madoff's massive Ponzi scheme killed himself in his midtown Manhattan office. The executive, 65-year-old Thierry Magon de la Villehuiche, or something like that, was found dead at around 8 a.m. with razor cuts to his wrists and arms and sleeping pills nearby in an office at 509 Madison Avenue. The address is home to Access International Advisors, which the now late 65-year-old Thierry co-founded. U.S. Army is ready if the downturn gets out of hand. Again, from the New York Post, are you afraid that the economic downturn could get out of hand? I mean, really out of hand? Well, don't worry. The U.S. Army War College is on the case, ready to handle, quote, unforeseen economic collapse and the rapid dissolution of public order in all or significant parts of the U.S. And you thought we were just dealing with a recession. In a report published on November 4th, just in time for the holiday season, the War College Strategic Studies Institute posited a number of shocks that the country should be prepared for, including unrest caused by the economy's failure. We, of course, went over the strategic shock paper from the Army War College back in November, but it's trickling down to the New York Post kind of tabloid rag. Moving to global research, the Federal Reserve Abolition Act. On June 15, 2007, Ron Paul introduced H.R. 2755, Federal Reserve Abolition Act. There were no co-sponsors, no further action was taken, and the legislation was referred to the House Committee on Financial Services and effectively pigeonholed and ignored. It's a bold and needed measure to, quote, abolish the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Banks, to repeal the Federal Reserve Act and for other purposes. The bill provides for management of employees, assets, and liabilities of the board during a dissolution period and more. Just a nice little reminder, again, that Ron Paul has been out there saying this for quite some time. And Peter Schiff and Jim Rogers and Rubini and Tlaib. Returning to the Associated Press. And again, it seems like there are times as I'm going through this where I say, no, I already went over that. And I have, in a way, because I went over it the 2 weeks ago where we were talking about cities and towns selling off their infrastructure to pay for the hole that everyone has dug themselves into with fake money and derivatives and bullshit. Cash-strapped states weigh selling roads and parks. Again, from the Associated Press. This time, Minnesota is deep in the hole financially, but the state still owns a premier golf resort, a sprawling amateur sports complex, a big airport, a major zoo, and land holdings the size of a Central American country of Belize. Valuables like these are in for a closer look as 44 states cope with deficits. Like families pawning the silver to get through a tight spot, states such as Minnesota, New York, Massachusetts, and Illinois are thinking of selling or leasing toll roads, parks, lotteries, and other assets to raise desperately needed cash. America is for sale. But it's not ideas and intangible, wonderful things. It's, or even, you know, products or even kind of services. No, it's the infrastructure. George Harrison pretty much nailed it a long time ago with the tax man. But to end, you know, this posting on a somewhat positive note, you know, what the fuck does Jim Rogers or Taleb, author of Black Swan, know? What are they talking about? Because Pulitzer Prize winning, or was it Nobel? Let's click the link. It's economist Paul Krugman telling CBS News that the current recession would not lead to another Great Depression.
How long do you see this recession lasting?
Oh, boy. It's not a simple question. I mean, I expect, if only because of all the money that the Obama administration is going to spend, I expect to see some pickup late 2009. But I think we're going to be in trouble for several years. This is going to be a tough, long-term slog.
In trouble. How deep do you see this going? And some people have made comparisons to the 1930s. Do you think that's fair and accurate?
You know, if we were as ignorant as we were in the 1930s, I think we would be facing a second Great Depression. You look at the scope of this thing. You look at, you know, we're in trouble, but go around the world. I mean, I've been looking at numbers for Ukraine, which are terrible. All around the world is this crisis taking place. The only reason that we're not headed for Great Depression 2, at least I don't think we are, is that we think we've learned a few things since then, so we're not trying to balance the federal budget in the face of a recession. But this is big stuff. This is the worst thing, you know, in two lifetimes.
Now it's time for all the latest 9/11 updates, and there are more than you would think. It's always there, as of course the great documentary says, it's the elephant in the room. The first posting of 9/11 updates goes back, again, actually, to December 26th. Lies, timelines, surveys, and foreknowledge. First, again, from Raw Replay and our friends at the Microsoft General Electric Network that bring us the man I love to hate to love, Keith Olbermann, where he points out that the White House owes an apology to 9/11 victims for a lie.
Number two, nexus of politics and Terrorgate. The president's ever-changing number of how many domestic attacks he prevented is backed up to numerous. Officially, that would be four based on his speech at the War College. We prevented numerous terrorist attacks, including an attempt to bomb fuel tanks at JFK Airport, a plot to blow up airliners bound for the East Coast, a scheme to attack a shopping mall in the Chicago area, and a plan to destroy the tallest skyscraper in Los Angeles. Well, it's skyscraper, but yeah, okay. The skyscraper was the one where Mr. Bush got the name wrong while announcing it to the world before he told the local authorities in Los Angeles that he was going to tell everybody, setting off mild panic there. The airliners one is the reason you can't bring liquids in your carry-on. The British-based scheme for which the plotters had not obtained a ticket nor passports, and chemists laughed at the idea anyway. The mall was the deal in 06 where the guy got no further than trying to buy a hand grenade from an undercover FBI agent. And the JFK plot, that was the mutant who thought he could cause an airport to blow up by starting a fire at a fuel pipeline 30 miles away. So thanks for stopping all these. Nice work, Jack Armstrong. And number one, insult the dead gate. This is a White House talking point still, even though your average three-year-old could disprove it using only an Etch-a-Sketch. Spokesman Tony Fratto on the air with Fox News parent John Scott. Scott gave the setup line about how 9/11 was unforeseeable and thus not even slightly Bush's responsibility, and said, I mean, nobody was thinking that there'd be terrorists flying 767s at buildings at that point. And Mr. Fratto replied, quote, that's true. I mean, no one could have anticipated that kind of attack, or very few people. Yeah, well, it ain't true, and out of respect for the people who died that day, you damn well better stop saying it. A president's daily brief as far back as December 1998 said, Bin Laden was preparing to hijack U.S. aircraft in hopes of trading hostages for jailed radicals. The August 6, 2001 brief, of course, told President Bush, if he read it, that there were patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings. The FBI agent John O'Neill repeatedly warned of the prospect of suicide hijackings, basically got drummed out of the bureau for saying it. The The FAA had distributed a CD-ROM early in 2001 to the airlines and the airports, warning that terrorists might hijack a plane in order to use it as a weapon. That Mr. Fratto's employers might not have been expected to know the exact hour of these attacks does not give him or anybody else the right to perpetuate the lie that 9/11 was impossible to conceive. Clearly, many inside this nation's government anticipated it. It was Mr. Bush and his gang who chose to ignore them.
Keith Olbermann hitting what we hit a couple weeks ago with Fratto and Fox News talking about no one could have ever thought the plane would be a... So again, good things from Olbermann. It's a shame once the Obama side is sworn in, he'll quit. The controlled opposition has been taken care of in the phony left-right paradigm. Olbermann, you can go back to Sports Night or Sports Center, whatever it's called. I'm not sure if it's still working, but The Nation magazine had up a survey, and of course, 9/11 blogger and Gators 9/11 Truth were trying to get him to cover 9/11. We'll see how that went. And as a side note, I don't think I've hit this up either, or posted it up, I should say, about trying to get 9/11 questions up the Obama-size change.gov site. And again, some, you know, regret. I can't be doing more of that. I'd like to have been active in that. I'd like to call up other talk shows and Truth Jam and do all those kind of things. It's just hard. A flashback, as of course, you know, it's tempting a lot of these times to say, you know, it's like, oh, new video shows that something on 9/11. And, you know, they're all generally not necessarily new videos, save for the ones we hit from Pentabomb.com recently. Those were new videos I don't believe we had ever seen before. Others are actually just, as we're going to hit again, MSNBC, older feeds that as we look at them again and again, as we learn more, more pieces somehow fit into this bizarre, labyrinthine, Byzantine, crazy, magic show, psyop terror event of 9/11. FDNY Lieutenant said WTC-7 would be taken down.
This was a 40-story building they have been watching all day. This is like watching the collapse of an active volcano. And the dust from it is not unlike that from a volcano. We are on the phone with New York Fire Department Lieutenant David Restuccio. Lieutenant, where are you right now?
I'm at the corner of Northmore Street and Greenwich Street.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes, sir.
And you guys knew this was coming all day?
We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that eventually it would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own. And we are just awaiting now at our triage for any other casualties or any other injuries.
Everybody all right where you are, Lieutenant?
Very, very much so right now.
So that's by way of 9/11 blogger, MSNBC live video during Building 7's collapse. And of course, we note how FDNY Lieutenant David Restuccio's comment that the building had been allowed to fall on its own, but also mentioning a plan that, quote, it would be taken down. One of the great ones that I've mentioned before that I wish I had more time to be more actively involved with is historycommons.org and the complete 9/11 timeline. Fortunately, for the last long while, I believe Kevin Fenton at historycommons.org always posts up a list, basically in a nice paragraph form, of the latest additions to the 9/11 timeline. So, as of December 22nd, the new entries we're about to go over, and of course a host more that always keeps spilling out. HistoryCommons.org. Additions to the 9/11 timeline as of December 22nd, the day of 9/11, and United 23. Most of the new entries in the 9/11 timeline again deal with the day of 9/11, shortly before which NORAD was preparing a major war game, Link. On the day itself, the Northeast Air Defense Sector NEADS called an air defense unit in Atlantic City just before the first plane at the World Trade Center, but the phone was not answered. Link. FAA manager Ben Sliney began responding to the crisis around the same time, and the airspace over New York was closed after the second plane hit. There are also new entries about another phone call from Flight 93 by passenger Andrew Garcia, a suspected hijack in the afternoon that delayed travel by President George Bush, and the lobby of World Trade Center 7, which was ruined by midday. Another additional entry covers United 23, which was thought to be a potential hijack target on 9/11. The potential alleged hijackers, or the alleged potential hijackers, were arrested when they returned to the airport a few days after the attacks, but soon released. Finally, the Air Force also started using a better radar system in Washington the day after the attacks, and the governor of Kentucky was nearly shot down over Washington in 2004. That should whet your appetite amazingly, and if we had the time, I'd love to just start hitting those links and following that down the rabbit hole. HistoryCommons.org, there's links up for you, and of course, a donation link to them as well. Jumping to the Washington Post, families ask Bush to seize land for the 9/11 memorial. Of course, this can only be happening in Shanksville. It's been more than 7 years since 20-year-old Deora Bodley and 39 of her other passengers and crew died in the fiery crash of United Airlines Flight 93, their hijacked plane disintegrating in a grove of hemlock trees outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Most of the remains from the tragedy on 9/11 were never recovered, making the bowl-shaped crash site in the western Pennsylvania countryside an unofficial cemetery and, for surviving relatives, sacred ground. But efforts to buy property for a national Flight 93 memorial have been bogged down in federal red tape and a protracted land dispute, angering family members and risking plans to hold a dedication ceremony on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The delays have prompted an advocacy group, Families of Flight 93, with a link, or rather a search for you on that one. Families of Flight 93 are asking President Bush to personally intervene during his final weeks in office to allow the federal government to seize the land needed for the memorial and to allocate part of the money for the project. Quote, he signed the Memorial Act. He wanted something to be there and to be in place for years and years to come, said Bodley's mother, Deborah Borza of San Diego. We have waited so long already. I hold on to being hopeful that between now and January 20th, something will happen. Something will break free. You and me both, Deborah. Landowner Mike Zvonovec of Zvonovec Incorporated of Somerset, Pennsylvania, said the National Park Service and Flight 93 groups are, quote, trying to make my company and myself look like the bad guy in this. And again, that's now a little bit a week or so old, but it still spills out. And even if it's a week old that I'm reading it to you, it's still always amazing as the story crumbles and yet somehow always seems to get more complicated in a way. Finally, on this first posting of 9/11 updates from Raw Story, conservative professor said the saddest part of 9/11 was the impact it had on Bush. Quote, for me, the saddest part about the terrorist attacks of 9/11 is the long-term impact on the presidency of George W. Bush, end quote, wrote Tony Campbell, an adjunct professor of political science with the Maryland-based Towson University, on The Moderate Voice. That's, of course, at themoderatevoice.com. Never mind the 3,000 Americans who died on 9/11 or their resulting wars or that one of the countries Bush chose to invade had nothing to do with the attacks or even the lingering unanswered questions as to just how exactly the 9/11 attacks were pulled off. More, of course, examples from Raw Story being closet 9/11 truthers. And again, thanks to my man Alex in Germany for always posting up pertinent information in the comments section, and I implore you guys, MediaMonarchy.com doesn't get tons of sites, or rather tons of comments on the site, but I encourage it. It could perhaps spring into something a little more lively, so hit it up. Anyway, second posting of 9/11 updates. This I just posted up today for you, January 8th, 2009. 9/11 updates, secret trials, White House moles, and hero myths. First, again, from the Washington Post, wouldn't you know it, judge's order could keep public from hearing details of 9/11 trials. The military judge overseeing proceedings against five of the men accused of planning the September 11, 2001 attacks signed an order designed to protect classified information that is so broad it could prevent public scrutiny of the most important trial at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, according to lawyers and human rights groups. The protective order, which was signed on December 18th by Judge Stephen R. Henley, H-E-N-L-E-Y, an Army colonel, not only protects documents and information that have been classified by intelligence agencies, it also presumptively classifies any information referring to a host of agencies, including the CIA, FBI, State Department. The order also allows the court in certain circumstances to classify information already in the public domain and presumptively classifies, quote, any statements made by the accused. Not sure how you classify something in the public domain, but I'm sure they'll figure out a way. Three of the accused, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. Three of the accused, including KSM, defending themselves and under the order, anything they say during the course of the trial could be shielded from the public. The rules turn the presumption of openness on its head, making what is perhaps the most important trial in American history presumptively closed to the public and the press, said Jennifer Daskal, Senior Counterterrorism Counsel at Human Rights Watch, HRW.org. If these rules applied in all cases, there'd be no such thing as an open trial in America. Second, William Safire hinted that a White House mole may have aided the 9/11 terrorists. This is a site I've seen a couple times. This, of course, came by way, again, always thanks to 911blogger.com. PetersNewYork.com is where this comes from. William Safire hinted White House mole may have aided 9/11 terrorists, where Peter Devin of PetersNewYork.com writes, "The discovery in my personal archives of issues of the New York Times and the New York Post from the days immediately following September 11, 2001 has become the basis for a several-part series on early reportage of the events of that day. The use of the original issues as opposed to electronic media has the advantage of easy reference and absolute reliability regarding the source. This third essay will explore the remarkable drama surrounding the activities of President George W. Bush on that fateful day. We find that once New York Times columnist William Safire, you should know that name, S-A-F-I-R-E, came into possession of the facts related to Bush's 10-hour absence from Washington, he concluded that a, quote, mole, end quote, in the White House may have cooperated with the 9/11 terrorist. He is thus joined at the hip with Robert Novak, who came to a similar conclusion in his column of the same day. The first one will hit, get you to William Safire, where at the very end, last paragraph of his article from September 13, 2001, Inside the Bunker, and of course there's all sorts of other questions around this as well. Last paragraph. That knowledge of code words and presidential whereabouts and possession of secret procedures indicates that the terrorists may have a mole in the White House. That, or informants in the Secret Service, FBI, FAA, or CIA. If so, the first thing our war on terror needs is an Angleton-type counter-spy. The other, Robert Novak, article, Beyond Pearl Harbor, from the New York Post, September 13th, 2008. First paragraph. Security experts and airline officials agree privately that the simultaneous hijacking of four jetliners was an inside job, probably indicating complicity beyond malfeasance. This makes all the more ominous Tuesday's national catastrophe and its dismal consequences. That's Robert Novak writing in the New York Post September 13th, beyond Pearl Harbor. Security experts and airline officials agree privately that the simultaneous hijacking of four jetliners was an inside job. So, three-parter from Peters, New York, and you have to check that out. Finally, on this 9/11 updates, secret trials, White House moles, it's time for some hero myths. This is a quick one from the Huffington Post. The myth of Bush as the hero of September 11th. This one's easy. Always, of course, limited hangout from the fine left establishment folks at the Huffington Post. As January 20th grows larger in the window, I've been thinking more about it, more often about the Bush legacy, specifically about certain aspects of the president's record that are in danger of being completely obliterated and replaced with myths and wholesale fiction. Some of this effort is, of course, the purview of Karl Rove and Karen Hughes and their legacy project, with a link. While rough drafts of revisionist Bush history are being contributed by certain establishment media hacks, desperate to chisel into the record their take on this outgoing president. For example, last week on a special episode of Hardball, my favorite insufferable hack, Times Mark Halperin, remarked that one of the president's greatest accomplishments was his response to the September 11th attacks, saying, quote, this is Mark Halperin, "I do think he deserves high marks for his public presentations after a rocky start in the first few hours. You can't be sure of it, but I'm confident that he performed there very well. Any other president may not have performed as well." Which other presidents? Lincoln after Fort Sumter? Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor? Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis? And at least Halperin interrupted his verbal dry hump to acknowledge, sort of, that President Bush sat there in a glazed stupor for 9 minutes after being told literally that America was under attack. Shifting gears now. NASA. And as I believe we've learned, that of course NASA is going to get into bed with the Pentagon, and the Obamasiah is making the bed. NASA issued a survivability report on the Columbia crash. This from Wikinews. NASA has issued a report on survivability during the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster entitled Columbia Crew Survival Investigation Report. It's massive. It's a 16.3 meg PDF that you can download, linked up for you from NASA.gov. Although the report finds the accident was impossible to survive, it still faulted a number of design issues with the astronauts' equipment. The accident investigation report was released in 2003, the year of the crash. During launch, on September 16th, the spacecraft's wing was holed when a chunk of foam detached and struck it. The shuttle then broke up on re-entry on February 1st, 2003, over Texas, killing the seven on board. This new report reveals details of what happened to the astronauts during the accident sequence, although some parts have remained confidential to the victims' families. The report reveals that within seconds of the breakup commencing, the crew became unconscious due to the rapid depressurization and that they never regained consciousness prior to their deaths. I also believe I heard in some spots that this was a rather graphic and gruesome report. NASA issues Columbia Crew Survival Investigation Report. But to the present day, a more recent disaster. This is going back to what a Christmas present for Tennessee. Friday, December 26, 2008, 500 million gallons of toxic sludge spill in Tennessee. This coming from the Tennessean, the Daily Tennessean. Millions of yards of ashy sludge broke through a dike at the Tennessee Valley Authority's Kingston coal-fired plant. That would have been Monday, actually. So whatever that was, December 22nd, December 22nd, 2008. Millions of yards of ashy sludge broke through a dike at the TVA's Kingston coal-fired plant, covering hundreds of acres, knocking one home off its foundation, and putting environmentalists on edge about toxic chemicals that may be seeping into the ground and flowing downriver. One neighboring family said the disaster was no surprise because they've watched the 1960-era ash ponds mini blowouts off and on for years. The ash slide, which began just before 1 a.m., covered as many as 400 acres as deep as 6 feet. The wave of ash and mud toppled power lines, covered Swan Pond Road, and ruptured a gas line. It damaged 12 homes and one person had to be rescued, though no one was seriously hurt.
Seeing this blackened moonscape, residents are still in disbelief. What hit eastern Tennessee Monday morning lit up emergency lines.
There's a heck of a mudslide or something that came through our backyard.
Not a mudslide, a sludge slide. In a retention pond outside a coal-burning power plant, sludge suddenly burst through a wall, sending 1.7 million cubic yards of it, enough to fill 520 Olympic-sized swimming pools into the surrounding neighborhood and into the Emory River. From that spot, it's only 5 miles downstream to the Tennessee River, the source of drinking water for millions. Sludge spread over 400 acres, pushing Crystal Flynn's house 30 feet off its foundation.
You can see where it's broke up.
Her family salvaging what they can before the house collapses.
Well, I've done all my breaking down, and I can't cry anymore, and I'm numb.
Another worry, all this sludge contains heavy metals like mercury and arsenic, so it's potentially toxic.
So far, water tests have come back negative for contamination, but it's still early.
Yeah, we're going to have to monitor, continue to monitor, to take a look. We don't know how far this is going to spread.
Removing sludge will go on for months, on land and in the rivers.
Stuff on the top, we're going to skim off, and then we're going to go back and dredge that material out.
But nothing can skim this disaster from Crystal Flynn's home.
I don't know if they're going to scoop all this stuff up, and the grass is going to still be there. You know, so it's just wiped out.
Wiped out by a falling mountain of sludge, and worried this disaster could get worse. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Harriman, Tennessee.
An update from thinkprogress.org. Tennessee disaster 3 times larger than the original estimate. Toxic sludge burst through a retention wall in eastern Tennessee, causing massive property and environmental damage. Federal studies have shown that coal ash contains significant quantities of heavy metals like arsenic, lead, and selenium, which can cause cancer and neurological problems. The incident, already being called the largest environmental disaster of its kind in the United States, may now be even worse than originally anticipated. Tennessee Valley Authority officials initially said that about 1.7 million cubic yards of wet coal ash had spilled in the disaster. Yesterday, however, the results of an aerial survey showed that the actual amount was 5.4 million cubic yards, or enough to flood more than 3,000 acres 1 foot deep. Millions and millions and millions and millions of gallons and gallons and gallons of toxic sludge spilling in Tennessee. We, of course, brace ourselves for further environmental catastrophes. And will they be used or engineered or man-made in some sort of Enviro 9/11 remains to be seen. But let's get the latest from Collateral News. This gets into a little bit of the police state brutality that we're, of course, going to go into more on tomorrow's episode 106. And, of course, of the riots. They're protests after someone was murdered is what they are. In Oakland, of course, cops shooting someone in the back. Oakland on fire. The latest episode of Collateral News posted up New Year's Day, Thursday, January 1st, 2009. Collateral News, Diamond Milburn. 3 undercover police officers accosted a 12-year-old girl in front of her home in a case of mistaken identity. 3 weeks later, she was arrested for assaulting them. She's scheduled to stand trial next month. Collateral News, Diamond Milburn.
On a quiet evening in Galveston, Texas in 2006, Emily Milburn asked her daughter, Diamond, to step outside and check on a circuit breaker that had just switched off. Just then, a blue van pulled up and 3 men poured out. One of the men grabbed the 12-year-old Diamond, covering her mouth as she tried to scream for help. 2 of the men beat her about the face and mouth as they tried to pull her into the van. All three of them were police officers, though none said they were, and none wore uniforms. And now, amazingly, the 12-year-old girl who was attacked, a girl who was an honor student at Austin Middle School at the time, is facing a criminal trial for assaulting them. It sounds like a hoax, right? If only it were. Welcome to Collateral. The police have told a strange tale. They say they were responding to a report of three white prostitutes in the area who were soliciting a white man and a, quote, black drug dealer, unquote. Now, leaving aside the question of whether or not such a report would justify this kind of action in the first place, Diamond Milburn, a young black girl, hardly fit the description. Plus, the police went to the wrong house two blocks away from the scene of the supposed solicitation. 3 weeks later, the police showed up at Diamond School and arrested her in front of her classmates for assaulting a police officer. None of the major points of fact in this case seem to be in dispute. The men were not in uniform. They came in an unmarked van, so it's entirely understandable that they appeared as criminals to a young girl and her family. Now, before you say that this will never go to trial, it already has. The judge declared a mistrial on the trial's first day and set a new date in February 2009. Diamond's family has brought a lawsuit against the city of Galveston, and some think the trial against her is being used as leverage for the lawsuit to be dropped. It's hard to imagine a case more clear-cut or a more obvious example of injustice. But because this is hardly the only instance where racism and sexism contribute to police brutality, it needs national attention. Imagine if the police had done this to an actual prostitute. It would be just as wrong, of course, but it's easy to imagine people caring a whole lot less. One positive note to report. Internet accounts of this story have circulated widely, and even on conservative websites where one might expect automatic support for law enforcement against a black family, support for Diamond and her family has been quite strong. In the case of the Gina Six, rightly or wrongly, there were great divisions in the country regarding the justification for the behavior of law enforcement. In this case, it's hard to imagine what the argument for police's behavior could even be. When the case comes to trial, we'll soon see. We'll keep you updated as events warrant.
Now, as we're winding up this B-side episode with some of my favorites from the alternative news world, Outside the Box, Alex Ansari. We just heard, of course, Collateral News. We're going to hear from my man Clyde Lewis in the Ground Zero Lounge in a minute. Right now, fortunately, my man Alex Ansari, I think he was a little behind, as well as we all are struggling just to live and work and be and pay rent and go to job and get through tons of snow in Portland and all that. He just recently posted up the three latest episodes of Outside the Box. So, episode 181... looks to cover, at least from the still on the Google Video Player, Outside the Box 181, covering, of course, Operation Board Games and the Chicago Combine and the Blagojevich, Rezko, and Obama crime syndicate. Outside the Box number 182, Alex interviews Dr. Rima LeBeau about, of course, Codex Alimentarius. And, of course, later Alex covers all the other news going on in the world. Links for you, of course, to read and hear more about Codex Alimentarius back to August 2008 on MediaMonarchy.com. And, of course, Dr. Rima LeBeau's website, HealthFreedomUSA.org. And, of course, there are also questions about her and Stubblebine and who's an agent and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Most recently, however, Outside the Box episode 183, originally broadcast December 23rd, Alex was snowed in. See how he entertained himself. And it is kind of funny in the still, again, that's on the embedded player. Looks like Alex is running down the grocery store aisle with getting a bunch of giant Mr. Good bars and Hershey's and snacks. Like a good little consumer. In part two of episode 183, he plays a clip, which we may have done as well, from Gerald Celente, of course, about the upcoming crash and, you know, civil war and revolution in the United States in 2009. Episodes 181, 182, and 183, all the latest from a man, Alex Ansari, at Outside the Box. However, just recently posted up on the YouTube channel DMP Truth, Alex Ansari, a glance at 2009. Host of Outside the Box, Alex Ansari, here giving a brief summary of what to expect in the coming months, as well as being prepared for the coming changes. Failing economy, uprising the police state, rising crime.
We're talking about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is comprised of China, Russia, Iran has now observer status, but China's petitioning for them to be a full member. Pakistan, Tajikistan, and a whole host of other nations, including Pakistan, who's also a nation that has observer status. This is the new military alliance that's being built as the case against the United States and the Western nations increases as a result of the damage our leaders or misleaders have done over the last couple of years. So we need to be aware in 2009 we're going to continue to see the economy get worse. Not a recession, but a full-blown depression that manifests with massive job losses. Right now, telling us it's about 7.6 in some states, 7.7, 8.1 here in Oregon, but that's conservative. It's in excess of 10 to 13, I believe, in our state alone. They keep the numbers low. They don't count the people that stop looking for work because they can't find work. So when people don't have money because they don't have jobs to pay for their rent, to pay for their food, and other things such as health care, you have angry people. Now we're hearing about bank bombings, bank robberies, things of that nature. We're going to see more of that happen because people feel that, well, the bankers are going to have all this money and the taxpayers are going to pay for, and our kids as well, for these trillion-dollar bailouts. We're justified in robbing the bank. And so you're going to see more crime escalating, but not just crime towards big banks, person-to-person crime, white-on-white crime, black-on-black crime, black-on-white crime, and vice versa. We're going to see a whole wave of crime hit the nation. Get through 2009, 2010, 2011, and whatever comes after that requires us to put aside some of that BS and deal with the reality that we are one, that we are affected by the things happening over there in the Middle East. And to deny that fact that we're a part of a human family is to be stuck in an illusion where we can continue to do this and face no repercussions, have no impact, have no blowback in any way, shape, or form, whether you call it karma, or whether you call it terrorism, or whether you call it an economic collapse, or whether you call it your society naturally becoming decadent because of all the violence they're exposed to in their world and on the TV set. There are repercussions, and we have to turn this around. So in 2009, we have to learn.
Alex Ansari to Alex Jones. Anytime I see the word ambient noise, it catches my eye. A quick, awesome little YouTube clip posted up. It's Alex Jones and the ambient noise of tyranny.
I can't even take off and go see a movie now because all I'm thinking about is the New World Order and all the stuff they're doing and how my going to a movie normalizes all of this. You know, we should be in the streets freaking out, pulling our hair out, but they just incrementally turn the tyranny up to where, you know, even I am acting insane. This is an insanely calm response to what they're doing. I mean, it's bad that they're putting fluoride in the water, and they knew it gave people cancer and attacked their glands and reduced their IQ by 20 points on average. I mean, that right there is mind-blowing. And now they're saying, yeah, melamine's good for you, mercury's good for you. Well, we used to say it was poison, but now it's good. Oh, you're dying. Good, dying is good. It's psych warfare. They're just throwing everything in our... And, you know, I can go read all the behavioral psychologists and psychiatrists and study it, and everything from Freud to Jung to Bernays to right through to the modern stuff, and they are practicing just savage. It's an art form, combinations of all these different psychological schools and brainwashing techniques and TV and neuro-linguistic programming and just subliminals, just targeting, just blasting people to where we all just, as they ambient, you know, the background noise, like crickets is an ambient sound. And they get louder and louder and louder and louder until it just shatters your eardrums. So that's the analogy. They're just slowly turning the sound up, slowly. But now it's already, now they're trying to crank it even faster. And it's not ambient anymore. It's blaring all around us. There's tyrannies everywhere. And people are kind of waking up, but they still have no idea how deep it is.
The ambient noise of tyranny. I feel that that clip and that idea goes along with what we're going to hear next from the recent Ground Zero Lounge first episode of 2009, I believe. Hindsight 2008, Foresight 2009. The future will be more of the past, returning again to remind us that we will still not have come to terms with our own buried fears and doubts about each other. Fear has been used to keep us in line, and soon fascism will be used to keep us imprisoned.
It's not happening abruptly, okay? It's kind of increasing slowly. It's inching its way in, okay? And you may not see it, you know, unless you're pulled over by a police officer and he's wearing a black outfit that kind of looks like something from the Stasi or from the Nazi era. All the Portland police officers wear black here, and they wear the utility belts, and they have the gun sidearm, and they look really scary. Well, you don't know about the police state until you've experienced it, and you don't know about the subtleties. You don't know about the propaganda that's reaching in and grabbing people. In fact, propaganda that starts with your children as well, and your grandchildren. Propaganda they're spewing forth as they're getting the child ready to live under the gun, which is what's going on. In fact, schools are doing that now, and they're preparing the children for this type of activity.
Clyde Lewis at the Ground Zero Lounge, Hindsight 2008, Foresight 2009. Of course, Clyde Lewis and the Ground Zero Lounge, recorded every Monday evening at Dante's Inferno, appropriately enough, in Portland, Oregon. And of course, you can always stream or download the episode. This one, however, like a few others, on video.google.com, you can watch this full episode, Hindsight 2008, Foresight 2009. There's another new one, too. And if I don't cover it here, I'm afraid I'm not going to have time to fit it in anywhere else. The latest from Ground Zero Lounge, this most recent Monday, January 5th, Wet-Wired, Converting to Tunnel Vision, Panopticon 2. As, of course, you recall from just a few weeks ago, Clyde Lewis's episode Panopticon, the Pandemonium Configuration, of course, all about the new digital conversion coming soon to a boob tube near you. Now, Wet-Wired, Converting to Tunnel Vision. Why is the government anxious to spend money to replace analog television signals with new digital technology? They're virtually turning your television into a computer. The catch is, you have no control over what it does. We're going to give the last word to the Honorable Dr. Ron Paul. A video from Campaign for Liberty where Dr. Paul discusses the invasion of Gaza and, of course, its implications for America. We're in for big, big, big trouble. And that's going to do it for this B-side episode 105 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato, host, webmaster, all-around crazed OCD host something. We're in big trouble. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take it away, Ron Paul.
Today, Israel invaded Gaza. they have been warning about this all along. Everybody anticipated it, and it finally happened. But to me, it's a pretty sad day for the whole world, because it just means that the whole idea of preemptive, preventative war is spreading. Israel says they have to go in and to prevent a problem that might come, and who knows for what other reasons. But, you know, the position that we should hold is that we should be on neither side. This is a conflict that's been going on for not decades, but hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. The people there have been fighting, but we're right in the middle of it. And even though Israel did the invading of Gaza, we, the United States, will be blamed for it. And there's some truth to this, because Israel depends on us. They depend on us economically. They depend on us for their military power and all their weapons. And they really got a green light from our administration. We have not said one word about the plan to go in. The plan has been there for a couple weeks, and everybody knew it was going to happen. So we are participants, which it just means that we have just antagonized the Muslim Arab world even more so than ever before, and unfortunately we'll suffer the consequences from this. But there is no benefit for us to be involved in this fight over there. This thing is an entire mess. The Palestinians are virtually in like a concentration camp. They have a few small missiles, but it's so minor compared to the firepower of Israel, who has nuclear weapons. And they can turn off all the food and all the water and whatever they want to the people in Palestine. And yet we are going to have to accept some of the moral responsibility for this. Now, one thing that I'm concerned about is the our government now is starting to say, well, you know, quite possibly the Iranians had something to do with this to egg on Hamas. Yeah, it could be. It might be the case. But this whole idea that we shouldn't have foreign powers involved, when you think of us being involved in Israel, it's so sort of an academic issue right now. But this to me is something that is going to spread, is very, very serious, and the Middle East is a powder keg, and unfortunately nobody sees an easy way out of the Middle East crisis that is ongoing right now. And it contributes to instability around the world. It contributes to the instability of our economic situation in this country today. We're involved in wars in Afghanistan. We're escalating the war there. We're pretending the war is over in Iraq, which it is not, and it's draining us. It's draining us emotionally, and certainly it's draining us financially. And as this whole area blows up, where are we even going to get the funds to keep this militarism going? And yet, nobody in Washington is really considering cutting back. Nobody's considering cutting back on the world empire. Everybody's frantic about the deficit. The deficit's totally out of control. It's anticipated that this fiscal year, the deficit, the national debt could increase by $2 trillion. Sure, they're still buying treasury bills, but how long is that going to happen? That is going to come to an end. I think that's going to be the big news this year, is people are going to be less enthusiastic about buying American debt. And this commitment overseas, as well as the commitment here at home to bail out everybody that gets in line, it just can't continue. Yet we're getting ready to start a new session. High on the agenda right now is another bailout package between $750 to $1 trillion. There's no money in the bank, and it's just going to come out of printing more money and hopefully borrowing money, more money from others. But other countries are going to get reluctant, and I see that this year, most likely the big event will be the further and maybe rapid deterioration of the dollar, which means we're going to have a lot of inflation. People say that the only concern we have now is deflation, but I see the concern about inflation. Inflation will come. There's still plenty of it around, and you can't create trillions of dollars of new money endlessly to bail out everybody and to police the world without it coming home to roost and really damaging our whole financial system. Everybody's frantic about what's happening, and they don't like it, but everybody is asking for the same thing that caused the problem. We were spending too much money. We were borrowing too much money. We had too much debt, and now we have a crisis. There's a deflationary move on right now that the market is demanding, and yet what are we doing? We're spending more money, running up more debt, borrowing more money, and printing more money. You can't solve problems that way. So the combination of the world crisis going on with this escalation going on in the Middle East, with our escalation deliberately in Afghanistan, and with the pretense that the war has ended in Iran, means that we're in for big trouble. We're in for big trouble on the world stage. stage, as well as we're in big trouble here financially at home. So though everybody is hopeful, and I would like to be hopeful with a new administration and a new Congress, and we wanted to change leadership, quite frankly, there's been no change in the philosophy of the leadership. The two parties, unfortunately, have both endorsed militarism abroad, the empire abroad, idea of inflation with the monetary system, deficit financing, the welfare state. Both parties have endorsed this. The last administration endorsed it. This administration endorses it. So the victims will be the innocent American people, and the real tragedy, it will be an attack on our personal liberties, because as governments get bigger, the economy founders, and there's more chaos, what happens is government gets bigger, they get more authoritarian at the expense of the liberties of each and every individual. So it is a time in our history that all of us ought to pay close attention and do whatever we can to alert the people, to educate the people, and do what we can to preserve those principles that were embedded in our Constitution.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
I mean, so it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.